This meeting is now being recorded.
Thank you. And can someone verify that you can hear me?
Hear you loud and clear.
Okay, great. Thanks, Greg. I guess since the recording came on when I asked for it, I should have known. First of all, I just wanted to say a huge thank you to everyone who's been working very hard over the last couple of days on this, not just the last couple of days, the last couple of months, but in particular the last couple of days. I know a lot of effort has been put in, and particular thanks to Josh and George, who had a lengthy engagement and have really helped us move along, I think, as far as I can tell from the mailing list. So I had sent just a sort of proposed agenda around to the list a couple of hours ago, whereby we would first go through the proposed resolution of selected legal issues, which George circulated not too many hours ago, and then pick up any other issues related to that are issues arising out of the community's reviews of the two agreements, anything that we don't cover in that first segment, and then move on to the documents circulated by Sam yesterday from ICANN, and then reserve a little time at the end to talk about next steps and future call scheduling. So any amendments or additions to that proposal? Okay, I see no hands. So if we could maybe load the proposed resolution document into Adobe, that would be good. And then I will turn it over to George or Josh, whichever one of you wants to kind of kick off and maybe explain to us what we have here before us.
Well, this is George. Josh, do you have any desire to walk us through this? I'm happy to, if not.
He says he's happy for you to lead in the chat, so go ahead.
There he is. Great. So, so thanks very much, everyone. I don't think we need to spend a huge amount of time on this piece of the agenda because I know that many of us have been discussing this, independently. But after the last call, if you remember, there were some legal issues that Josh and I wanted to try to hash out, one-on-one, seemed to be blocking or, important to get out of the way so that we could talk about the larger points in the agreement with everybody. And so we've tried to do that, and there were, I guess it's now seven of these legal points that we talked about for quite a while, have talked about with some of you offline, and the result is this document that we sent around last night, which I can, go through briefly, right? The issues mostly relate to the IETF Trust's different constraints and duties put upon it, both under trademark law, but more importantly by the law of trusts and the fiduciary duties that are imposed on the trustees not to divest their intellectual property once it comes into the trust, and to use their fiduciary duty to shepherd and maintain the intellectual property that they possess. So with that, we talked about a number of issues that touch on those duties and obligations. The first one, which is somewhat related to that, is really who the licensee should be under the license agreements. And we've heard various opinions about whether it should be ICANN or PTI. And to make a long story short, I think everyone has gotten comfortable with ICANN being the licensee, since it has the primary obligation under the SLAs to provide the IANA services. There would be three separate licenses to ICANN, one for each different service. Each of those separate licenses could separately be terminated, and the termination we'll talk about in point number two. At the end of the day, I think everybody is comfortable with ICANN then sublicensing that the rights that it gets under the license to PTI or whoever the then current service provider is for that IANA service, as long as ICANN remains in the picture and remains liable, responsible for whatever its sublicensees do. And I think that's the important part from the trust standpoint. So that's item one. Item two, and by the way, if anyone has questions during this, I suspect they should just jump in or raise their hands or whatever, happy to address the points as we go.
Yeah, so, I think talking about the raising hands usually works well in Adobe, so people should raise their hands if they want to jump in.
Yeah, and I'm not sure I can see everybody's hands, just the way my window is set up. So feel free to, moderate and jump in if somebody needs to go. So we have these three licenses. There's a procedure for granting the licenses that I think is, not that controversial in the community agreement. Terminating the licenses, though, did become controversial. And I think where we've landed on this, subject to everybody's agreement, is that the trust doesn't intend to sort of go wild and, terminate these important service trademark licenses on its own, right? It needs to consult with the operational communities, the relevant operational community for the service that's being provided. It won't terminate that license unless, one of two things happen. Or no, that's an echo. Somebody has their mic open and I was hearing myself, interrupting myself. So there are only two conditions under which the trust could terminate one of these licenses. One is with the support of the relevant operational community. If that happens, and we think this is going to be the more normal course, the operational community will assess whether or not the service provider is complying with their service obligations. If not, and if there's a decision to move the service to another service provider, the OC will just tell the trust about that, and then the trust will terminate that license and grant a new license to the new service provider. Letter B, under the first bullet point, is a situation where the trust feels itself that there's something wrong with the services that are being provided, and that's damaging or tarnishing in some way the trademarks that it needs to protect. And so if that happens, the trust would not just outright terminate the license. It would seek an independent fact finder determination to tell it and confirm whether or not the services are being provided up to the standard that they're supposed to be provided to. With that independent fact finding, if it does turn out that the fact finder says the services are not up to the standard, and that there's a material breach of the license agreement, then the trust will be able to terminate the license agreement with appropriate notice periods and transition periods and so forth, so that there's no disruption or interruption in the services, which I understand is very important. The third point about termination is that it's always possible that one of the licensees will go off and do something that's not authorized by the license, offering web hosting services or something under the IANA name. If that happens, it's not really a matter of breach of contract, right? It's a matter of intellectual property infringement because that activity is not authorized. And so the last thing that would help the trust in this area is just to acknowledge in the community agreements and the license agreements, that unauthorized use of the IANA IP is outside of the license and can make the licensee subject to an IP infringement suit totally outside of the license agreement. But it wouldn't result in a breach or termination of the license agreement. So that's number two. And so number one and two really deal with the license agreement and the relationship with the licensee. So number three and four really relate to the question of how the trust is going to safeguard and preserve the intellectual property that's put under its trust. Number three deals with maintenance. The trust is already obligated under its trust agreement to maintain IP that's in its possession. It actually can't abandon IP without going through a process that involves the community and a showing that the IP has no value. So we'll commit to that in the community agreement. If somebody, one of the licensees or the operational communities, think that the trademarks or domain should be registered elsewhere, I understand the IANA marks are primarily registered in the United States, but say there's another country that folks think it's important to register the marks in. The trust is going to consider all of that in good faith. Because the trust has a limited budget, it may not be able to afford all of the registrations that others request. And if that's the case, the trust, the third bullet says, we reserve the right to get reimbursed for that registration cost from the requester, whether it's the licensee or the operational community. These costs aren't huge. As you know, it's probably a few thousand dollars per country at most, but, you know, if you multiply that by 150 countries, it could be significant. So we just need that safety valve to make sure that we're not somehow bankrupted by for complying with those requests. And it's optional. We don't have to ask for reimbursement. The flip side
George,
of
let
maintenance
me,
is – oh, yes, go ahead.
Sorry, this is Josh. If I could just jump in on one point of clarification on number three, maintenance of IANA IPR. I think you mentioned that this, you know, that there'd be commitment to this and to maintaining in the community agreement, but I assume that we also, the trust would commit to maintaining it in the actual license to the licensee so that the licensee would know that those commitments are there and that it could request other registrations, you know, at its expense if need be.
You know, we had been talking about this and thinking about this in the context of the operational communities. The licensee, I mean, I'm not sure. You know, we should discuss that. What obligations go in the license agreement versus the community agreement? I guess I would want to hear from ICANN. About, you know, why that would be important to them. Remember, the marks are only registered in the U.S. at this point, yet ICANN will be providing services around the world. What difference does it really make to the service provider that the marks are maintained? I guess I'm not understanding what incentive and what value they would be trying to preserve when today there is no protection in, you know, the majority of the world for those same marks. The operational communities I do understand, but again, I'm not opposing it. I just want to understand the motivation better.
Okay, I mean, I don't know if Samantha Eisner is on the call and if she wants to speak for ICANN Legal or address some of these things when it comes up later. But it would seem to me just sort of in ordinary course that the licensee would want that commitment and the trust is already committing to do this, not expanding the commitment, the trust is already committing to do this with respect to the operational communities and would be appropriate to include it in the actual license grant too. But if there needs to be, you know, we have to move through things. So if there needs to be further consideration, maybe we need to take it up somewhere.
Yeah. Again, I'm not opposed to it. I just hadn't really thought. I mean, when I thought through it, I didn't I just didn't get it that well. But again, I'm open to being persuaded and open to hearing what other people have to say.
So there's a bit of a queue now. I think Andrew is next.
Thanks. Yeah, so on this topic, I actually have a concern about that sort of duplication. Because it seems to me what it does is it introduces these for, you know, differences between these kinds of agreements and future interdependencies, if, you know, if anything needs to be updated, that strikes me as a bad thing. I, of course, am not a lawyer, but in engineering terms, if you do this kind of thing, you regret it later. So normally what I would prefer is really to have a reference, you know, saying, and there is this other agreement and, you know, and there are some terms that govern things there. And then that, provides the licensee with the assurance that, you know, there is this other commitment that's already in existence. And so the licensee gets that. That's the direction that I would prefer we lean. And you know, there were some other comments, like I saw a number of comments from ICANN about the license agreement that it was in a sort of similar vein of duplicating, and it worries me a little bit because it makes our task here quite a bit harder.
Thanks, Andrew. Greg is next.
Thanks, Greg Shatton, for the record. Apologize, it would be somewhat legal comments. But first, I'd be concerned about taking an approach that has too many stated interdependencies between the community agreement and the license agreement that may actually get us into more trouble rather than less. Obviously, they do have a certain amount of interdependencies that we've already baked in, but adding even more might be troublesome. Don't know, but in terms of keeping things kind of simple and standard, I have to say from my day job experience that it's, you know, bog standard for the licensor to commit to maintain, you know, keep the marks registered. So a little concerned that we're kind of finding that a point of resistance just because I think we have to get through a lot of issues, and I think that if we kind of can find middle grounds very quickly on things, and I'll say that for ourselves as well, that it's better than if we kind of inch toward things. So last, kind of on the maintenance of the IPR, I'm not sure if this, to my mind, it kind of falls under the same, you know, general category in terms of viability under trademark laws, that there should be a certain amount, and that amount is somewhat, doesn't have to be defined in the agreement, it's somewhat squishy, of policing of the mark, which may simply be a matter of engaging a standard watching service, which is, again, you know, a bog standard sort of thing to do, to at least watch for applications made on the U.S. Register, and I'll leave it to paid counsel to work out, you know, what might be appropriate, and obviously ICANN may have a view on that as well, interest, you know, see what they've already been doing, but, you know, hand someone who's handled a lot of trademark portfolios, you know that, you know, keeping an eye out for registrations and potentially infringements through, you know, cost-effective means is kind of, you know, part of the basic approach. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. Josh, do you want to come back in?
Yeah, just to point out, and then I think you should move on, George, that, you know, when we were setting this up in some of the exchanges that, you know, and obviously we weren't making firm commitments, it has to be done by the communities, but we did talk about this as being the licensee being able to request, you know, additional registrations and the IETF Trust being able to require the licensee to pay for that. And I think if we're going to have that, then that needs to be a, you know, that needs to be an obligation set in that license agreement where there's privity between the parties. So, okay, but you know, please, so we don't get bogged down, you should, I'd suggest you move on.
No, but fair enough. I mean, as I said, you know, I wasn't necessarily opposed to it. I think I've heard a lot of very convincing arguments right now. And, you know, also Greg had thrown in this point about policing, which we haven't included in this sheet, but it is something that actually we did talk about internally with the trust yesterday. And I do think there is, you know, there is some level of policing that is probably appropriate here for the trust to do. Again, you know, I think one of the conundrums that we have with this license, and one of the things that makes it different from your typical off-the-shelf trademark license agreement, is that, you know, the licensor isn't receiving a royalty here, and that is, you know, often what drives the obligations that the licensee can place on the licensor. I'm paying you X amount, you know, to get a license as trademark. You ought to maintain it. You ought to police it, and so forth. You know, the financial polarities are just different in this agreement. So you know, that might be something to think about as we add these types of obligations into the license agreement. You know, having a financial support mechanism to make sure they happen might be something for the group to think about. So, okay. So off of maintenance enforcement, I mean, there is this flip side, you know, with policing, whoever does the policing, infringements of the marks may be detected around the world. The trust, we've discussed the trust having the initial right but not the obligation to bring infringement suits against those third-party infringers. That kind of goes hand-in-hand with trademark law. One thing that we have conceptually agreed to that was requested was to allow the licensee, if it requests it, to enforce the IP itself against the third party if the trust decides not to do it on its own. You know, exclusive licensees often do have standing to bring suits to enforce trademarks against infringers. The exclusive licenses in this agreement are a little bit strange. They're not truly exclusive. They're exclusive in a field. So, you know, legally, it may or may not work, depending on what the country is, for the licensee to bring suit to enforce the mark. But, you know, there's nothing we can do about that. That's something that will resolve itself in the courts, wherever these suits may be brought. And we have nothing really to say about that. That suit would, of course, be at the licensee's expense. And what we've left open, because, again, Josh and I were really just trying to put to rest some of these legal issues, is what would happen to the recoveries, right? If there's an infringer and, you know, we win $10 million from the infringer and everybody has spent $1 million in legal fees, there's $9 million in damages that goes somewhere. Somebody gets to keep it, or we split it up in some way. And how that happens is really a business matter. On one hand, the trust is the owner of the intellectual property. On the other hand, the licensee is building a business around the intellectual property in the jurisdiction. So, you know, there are various ways to split it up. I don't know if that's a discussion that people want to have now. But it's, again, it's something that Josh and I put on the side because, again, even though we can make plenty of suggestions, it really is a business question for the principals and not the lawyers. And if nobody wants to jump in on that question, I can move on, but I can see if anybody wants to say anything.
So this is like just Sorry, was there someone who was coming in?
That was just me, sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, like, honestly, from where I sit, if you guys can write something down and we can look at it, then, like, the potential for this to have any meaningful effect on the ITF community is, like, so remote that I don't think, like, we have anything to propose, but probably whatever you guys come up with, we can look at and say that seems reasonable or not. I understand that it's not really a legal issue, but I think you're better qualified to write something down than the ITF community people would be, so.
It's easy enough to write down, and when, you know, we could even put some options in. The question is just who keeps the money? Trust, the licensee, or somebody else. So fair enough. We can put in some options maybe in the next draft, and then people can think about this. The fifth point, basically just talks about the overall relationship under the community agreement. The trust had requested that it not be bound to seek the approval of the CCG to make some of these decisions. And, that's part of our governance structure, part of our view of how we view our fiduciary duties. And so we appreciate CWG and the other communities have taken that on board. And what we're willing to agree to, and I think is very fair, is that, of course, there's consultation between the trust and the CCG with many of these questions. And when the trust consults with the CCG, we'll put in writing that we'll give thoughtful consideration to its advice and recommendations. And more than that, there's going to be a presumption that we'll take the advice. Or the trustees will take the advice, and they don't have to, but the general presumption would be that they would. If they don't, the trustees would say why, right? There's not just a, just say no policy. It would have to be, explained. And I think that's a very fair and transparent way to allocate this relationship. Okay. And so then point number six is kind of the negative loop in this discussion. Well, the communities and ICANN are entrusting to the trust valuable asset. What happens if the trust goes rogue and, just violates this agreement left and right, doesn't do what it's committed to do? Under the trust agreement, as it's written today, the assets have to stay in the trust. Trust is not legally permitted to transfer assets out of itself. And, this is a very strict requirement. We've run into problems in the past with this with, tangible old computers that we wanted to donate to a charity. This is technically not allowed. The communities, not unreasonably had requested in their drafts of the agreements that if the trust breached in some particularly serious way after a lot of dispute resolution, the assets should be moved somewhere else to some other repository. While we can't agree to that right now because of the way the trust agreement is written and because there is no time right now to go through the process of amending the trust agreement, we can't agree to that request right now. But what the trustees are willing to do is that when requested by the CCG, the trustees will begin a process of seeking an amendment to the trust agreement. And the trust agreement is amended by the trustees, but with IETF community, basically, advice and consent. And, that process is a back-and-forth process that takes some time. That request would be made. The trustees wouldn't make it unilaterally. They would have to be requested by the CCG, but that request could come fairly soon after the agreements are signed. if that amendment is approved, then, you know, there we would, I guess, need to reconvene this group at some point to amend the community agreement to put in place some kind of transfer provisions. And there were some pretty lengthy transfer provisions that CWG proposed. I mean, I think that would be a starting point. I think we'd need to, you know, to talk about them and, you know, figure out in some detail how they would work. I don't think we need to do that today. I think that's a job for after this transition actually happens. The other piece of consolation for the operating communities right now is that, you know, a court can always order something to happen, notwithstanding what the trust agreement says. If a court says, trust, you breached this agreement so egregiously that we're going to order these assets moved out of the trust, you know, that could happen, and the trust probably would not be able to stop that from happening. So if there's a bad enough breach and the communities do want to go to court, do request that a court take the assets away from the trust, even without this amendment to the trust agreement, conceivably it could still happen, and we're willing to put that in writing in the trust agreement. The last point, number seven, is kind of a pretty small point that only lawyers could love, which is which U.S. state laws will govern the agreements, and for consistency's sake, I think we are willing to agree to California law, just because that's where the bulk of the agreements and the SLAs, you know, are going to be governed. And happy to discuss or answer any questions about that. There are various other reasons here. So that is my report on this document.
Thank you very much, George. I think I'm glad we spent the time to go through it in some detail. Anybody have questions or comments on any of the details that George talked about? Go ahead, Greg.
Thanks, Greg Shatton, and thank George for walking us through that, and you know, George and Josh for, you know, kind of getting us out of a loop, potential loop that we might have been in on these kind of overarching issues. And I think my cautious optimism is a little less cautious than before, so that's a good thing. One point that I just wanted to comment on that I didn't comment as it went by is kind of on the end of item five, the last bullet point. Really, there is no bullet point, but that if it does not accept the advice, it will state the reasons why. I would like there to be at least, you know, a discussion or something other than kind of we listened and these are the reasons why we're not going to and we're moving on. Informally, it'd probably be a good idea to have another discussion with the CCG, see if there's some way to move to have something that's more mutually satisfactory. I don't want to have any kind of heavy formalistic overhang of a process for that, but, you know, a sentence or half a sentence, you know, that says that there'll be the right to, you know, consult and see if there's a mutually agreeable solution might make sense after that, you know, understanding that if there isn't one, then that's the end of the discussion, and the trust moves on and does what it's decided to do. I'm kind of thinking in the back of my mind about how the ICANN board deals with GAC advice, or at least what it says in the ICANN bylaws. In fact, they tend to try to talk to the GAC before anything really formal, you know, tends to gel and work things out before you get to kind of a formal, you know, exchange of views, but it's just a thought. Thanks. I hope not mediation. I'm thinking something more informal than mediation, although and not something that necessarily really involves counsel unless there's a feeling that it really needs to, that it's that critical. You know, I'm hopeful that people can talk about these things and more or less, you know, assuming they're more or less business issues, you know, as in a practical way. I'm just concerned about making it anything, you know, too heavy duty versus lightweight. And mediation can be very informal. It's just a third party who is basically refereeing a discussion between the other two parties. And it doesn't have to be, you know, a heavy duty process, and it doesn't have to involve lawyers or travel. But yeah, just the idea that this isn't kind of a one shot discussion, because the consultation, right, I think we need to find something that's in between kind of one shot and the, you know, seven steps of hell that was written into the agreement by the that I wrote, that came from the CWG.
So just to respond really quickly, I don't have any objection to anything anything at all that you just said, other than excluding lawyers and travel. But no, just kidding about that. You know, I think Alyssa wants us to talk at the end about process and moving forward, but getting a proposal on that would be very welcome.
Thanks, George. Athena, go ahead.
Yes, hello. This is Athena Fraguli from RIPE-NCC. I'm talking on behalf of all RIRs now. In principle, we are comfortable with all the points as presented by George. And about the issues that came up during George's presentation, we don't have a strong opinion. So actually, we're looking forward to the actual text and wording and to comment on that. Thank you.
Thanks. Good news. Ted, go ahead.
So I just wanted to make the point that I think we could definitely include something which described a consultation. I think the intent of what I heard Greg saying was to ensure that if there were a request to the trust, that the trust intended to deny, that there was some form of dialogue. And I think that making sure that the community agreement or other appropriate places note the need for that dialogue and consultation is absolutely a great idea. I think that what would worry me slightly is if we tried to be too descriptive about what form that dialogue needed to take, exactly because of the informal nature, that might be the most successful way of moving things along in the case that this did occur. And I'm wondering if there's a mechanism that we can use here that simply describes after consultation, if it intends to deny a request, that it will engage in a consultation with the appropriate party. If that would be enough to move us along here, whether we need to go further.
Thanks, Ted. That makes a lot of sense to me. And it looks like we have some further refinements happening in the chat as well. So it sounds like we can come up with some sort of approach to this that would alleviate Greg's concerns. Anything else on the details? Okay. So I think broadly speaking, where we are is that the trust and all three of the operational communities are comfortable with what's been outlined here. In our next agenda item, we're going to talk about some other things that aren't covered by these six or seven points. And then after that, let's maybe circle back to the question of what the process is for getting this turned into text. But I think as far as these points are concerned, the next step is to look at the actual contractual text and, you know, hopefully if it just reflects what we've discussed here, then it will be pretty straightforward for us to come to consensus on. So why don't we move on to other items arising from the operational communities? I know we got, there's been some back and forth with the RARs. I'm not sure if there's things that people feel that they need to discuss or if there's outstanding issues, but obviously the 7 points were the key things, but not the only things. So if we didn't really intend to, like, walk through paragraph by paragraph or anything like that, but if there are specific items that people feel are still unresolved or that they feel need discussion in the from the community reviews of the agreements, then now's the time to chat about those. I'm not seeing any hands. Oh, okay. Greg, go ahead.
Thanks. A couple of things. And one thought is perhaps on the license agreement, not the community agreement, but to kind of move on to item three on the license agreement and then see, you know, if we want to work any discussion of any community concerns on the license agreement into that discussion. On the community agreement, which I can't hasn't commented on, I think now would be the time. I've kind of quickly turned to the chart that Josh prepared and circulated on the community agreement to see what we have here. Maybe I'll ask Josh to look at what we have here that's kind of separate, you know, that isn't solved for in some, you know, material fashion by what we've just discussed, and that's kind of, you know, different. I'm looking at the chart again, you know, quickly, and nothing is jumping out at me. I think that we may be in pretty good shape, but I'll stop talking, see if anybody else has any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I was sort of thinking of this as the wrap up of the sort of community portion, and then we can shift to the ICANN portion. And obviously, there are comments on the same documents, at least about the license agreement. So we may end up sort of circling back. But George, go ahead.
Yeah, in sort of thinking about, and I know I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but I think it's appropriate now to think about what we're actually doing, or what probably I am doing, tonight, which is, you know, I think the 7 points, they're kind of meta issues, and they address, you know, probably half of the different comments in the agreements. And, you know, my thinking is that we turn these agreements based on both the input that RIR, that Athena sent around just before this call, plus these 7 points, and try to, you know, narrow it down to just anything that's outstanding. So at this point, you know, it would be great if for the remaining issues, you know, just like Greg had mentioned policing of the mark, that was good. Glad we talked about that. If there are other issues that aren't covered by the 7 points or the RIR's note, you know, let's just get them out there and try to flatten those, you know, other than just the really trivial stuff, so that the next version of the agreement is, you know, is something that is, you know, say 80% there instead of, you know, whatever it is now.
Yeah, thanks, George. That's what I was going for as well. Greg, go ahead.
Thanks. It's one issue that hasn't been discussed yet, and while I believe it came up in the ICANN draft on the license agreement, it also, you know, comes up in our discussion, or came up in our discussions as well, and was an area where there was, I think, a, you know, some discussion would be helpful, which is kind of the quality control and delegation of quality control, and quality control is, you know,
under U.S. law, a requirement that the trademark owner engage in some form of quality control directly or indirectly. Not necessarily a requirement under other jurisdictions, but it, without that, it's considered to be an abandonment of the agreement of the IP. But we have discussed that because the three communities are actually receiving the services and have put in place mechanisms to monitor and assure themselves of the quality of the services they're receiving, that it would be more practical to have it done by the communities and some communication back to the licensor. And a final aside, and then I'll stop talking. People often confuse quality control over the services with the licensor's control over display of the mark. I've sometimes seen license agreements where the only quality control was over the display of the mark, and that's very, very bad mistake. Both of those are things that typically the licensor has some control over, that need to be addressed. So just those things, the closer we can get those issues to stability, the better. Thanks.
So, listen, can I respond to that?
Yes. Yes, please, go ahead.
Is there anybody else? So I agree with this. I think we all, know the law around quality control. I and Athena in her comments, raised the quality control issue also. And for those who haven't had a chance to look at that note from RIR, their proposal is to link the quality requirements under the trademark license more closely to the service agreements, the SLAs, that define the services. And, I have no problem with that because that, I think, at the end of the day, is the only thing that you can do. And those, of course, then would be different for each of the three license agreements. But to Greg's point, I guess I'm just sure we do have some quality control sort of responsibilities, or at least options, for the operational communities in the community agreement. And I guess is it, and I'll just read it because it's, section 3.2F, where we said that each of the OCs may monitor the operator's use of the IP with respect to its designated service for purposes of quality control under the license agreement, and shall promptly notify the trust of any failures or deficiencies, and so forth. And then the trust is going to coordinate with the OC in communicating and seeking to address those failures. Is there, and again, I'm not trying to be confrontational, I'm just wondering, is there more that we should be saying, or should we be saying something different?
So I put myself in the queue because I do have a thought about this. I guess what I'm just looking back at Athena's recommendation as well, and maybe I'm in the rough here, but it seems to me that what the license agreement and what the community agreement say aren't exactly the same, and I know that I agree with the idea that the entities that are evaluating the quality of the services provided are the operational communities exclusively. I guess what I'm missing a little bit is the notion that the trust now also will have some sort of obligation to evaluate the quality of the actual service provided, as opposed to what the text that you just read, George, which is an evaluation of the quality of the use of the mark, which makes a lot of sense to me. But the evaluation of the quality of the services, whether they're based, you know, whether they're, you know, benchmarked against the SLAs or not, it doesn't seem like something the trust should be in the business of doing, and is, you know, completely outside the scope of everything else in the transition proposal and the agreements that have been signed as a result of that. So it seems to give the trust some sort of role that it really properly shouldn't have. Quality of the use of the mark makes sense to me. Quality of the services, whether they're benchmarked against the SLAs or not, doesn't make a lot of sense. Athena, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Actually, I do agree with Alisa's point, especially because in our SLA, not in the SLA, sorry, in our proposal for the transition, we have established a body to perform such reviews for the quality of the service, the review committee. And so if now the trust does that as well, it won't be clear which part of the review belongs to the trust and which to the review committee, and whether there is an overlap, and it won't be clear what's the trust's role there, especially because we have like a community supporting this job to be done by a specially established review committee on that. So we would propose not to give this this power to trust, but I would like some clarification on whether this is a requirement by law and how far this requirement goes. Thank you.
Thanks, Athena. George, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. So I can respond to I think each of you. So I honestly don't think that we're disagreeing here in terms of who's doing what and who's reviewing the services. I think maybe where some of the concern is coming from is how the agreements are structured. And this is kind of a meta issue, so it's worth spending a minute to talk about. We're dealing with two agreements. One is between the trust and the OC, right? That's the agreement that sets up how the trust handles this intellectual property. And that's the agreement that has the paragraph I just read to you that says the operational communities are going to monitor the quality, and we're going to talk about it. Now, that is all behind a curtain. As far as the service provider, as far as ICANN goes, right? ICANN only has a license with the trust, two-party agreement. So all of the interaction with ICANN occurs through the trust. Now, behind the trust is this four-party agreement where we take advice from, seek advice and take advice from the OCs and, you know, all of the procedure and process that we've talked about. But when it comes to the license agreement, it really is a two-party agreement. And maybe, Greg, maybe that's where you were going with your comments before, and I misunderstood. But it's because I remember now that in the CWG's initial set of comments on the draft, there was a lot of stuff in the license agreement about the OCs. And we propose removing that or not including it because, you know, that's not the licensee's business. What happens behind that curtain between the trust and the operational communities is private, or I don't know, it's probably made totally public, but at least, you know, the contractual, it doesn't impact the contractual relationship between the trust and the licensee. And remember, the licensee isn't always necessarily going to be ICANN. It can be somebody else. That agreement can be transferred in all the ways we've talked about. And so the trust is kind of the front person for this relationship. The quality control, you know, the termination, all of these things between the licensee and the trust just happen in the license agreement. the trust can't do so. The trust has to consult with the OCs before it takes action under the license agreement, has to get the feedback, has to get the input on quality control. But in dealing with the licensee, the trust is the one who does it. And that's why they're different. That's why the two agreements look different. And it looks like the trust is doing stuff beyond its competency in the license agreement. But it's okay because all of the, you know, all of that backup and all of the interaction with the OCs happens in the community agreement. And I don't know if that helps. But I think that's getting to what I am hearing is some of the concern.
Thanks, George. Go ahead, Josh.
Yeah, George, this is, I just wanted to give, I think you hit upon the issue that does seem to cause some angst in the communities and maybe others, you know, with respect to the perception that the trust might be, you know, getting out over its skis on quality control and policing under the license agreement because there isn't all of the kind of rigor and deference to the independent processes for review of the IANA services that have been set up by the various communities. That's what we were, in our comments by CWG, we were trying to make it clear that although the trust has sort of the legal obligation to police the mark, it wouldn't take action with respect to, it was delegating its authority and control over kind of reviewing the services and the quality of the services that are being provided to the various communities. You know, of course, we were speaking for the NAMES community, but it applies to everybody else. That it was delegating that to those communities pursuant to their independent processes. And I know that was struck from, you know, an earlier draft of the trust agreement, of the license agreement, but maybe to help, you know, provide that appeasement, or, you know, sort of soothe that angst, it might be appropriate for the next turn of the draft to include language that, to that effect, that with respect to the, you know, the acknowledging the trust has an obligation to police the mark, and the license marks, but that with respect to the quality of services that are being provided, the quality of the IANA services that are being provided by the IANA service provider to the various communities, that it is deferring to the operational communities and delegating that authority to review those procedures to the operational communities, would, I think, provide a lot of comfort in that regard, that there wasn't going to be some sort of super kind of or extra oversight that the trust could exert over the IANA services independent of the community review processes.
Thank you, Josh. Go ahead, Greg.
Just briefly, agree with what Josh said, and I would just add that, you know, looking back at what I think is the current 3.2F in the community agreement, it just says that each of the operational communities may monitor the operator's use of the IANA IP. And I don't think, unless I'm, you know, missing things, that there's an actual delegation to them here. And, you know, in return, it would require a hard commitment to monitor, again, because actual failure to exercise quality control can lead to abandonment of the trademark. So I think, you know, the mechanism needs to be more apparent. And the very last point I'll make is that, you know, I'm assuming that consistent with all the other procedures that we've undergone, these agreements will be publicly available to the world. So the curtain, such as it is a legal fiction. The reality is that, you know, the agreements will be published to the world. And it just needs to be clear, you know, how this will work.
So, but Greg, just to make sure that this is clear, I thought what Josh was saying is that what maybe needs some refinement is to make it clear that the trust's responsibility is the quality control of the marks, and the community's responsibility is the quality control of the services. Do you agree with that proposition?
I think on at least a formal technical level, there is kind of a slim wrapping around the community's actual monitoring, that there is a legal requirement that the trust at least make sure that quality control is being monitored. They don't necessarily need to be the monitor. That's why they would delegate it to those who are, in fact, already being tasked with that very aspect and are actually much more expert in judging for their communities whether the services are being delivered with an adequate level of quality. So it's really just kind of a reflection that the license agreement, I think, does need some reflection that there is a quality control is taking place by the licensor, and by which I mean quality control over the services. But I think that, and the way I saw these agreements coming out of the CWG, it was clear from the license agreement where that quality control was actually taking place. And I do prefer that construction, even if it's not, you know, strictly necessary, you know, to kind of tell ICANN, the licensee, that that's happening. I think it's better for the purposes that we've just been discussing for the last few minutes for it to be really out there. And again, to avoid the idea that there's going to be kind of independent and extra quality control taking place by the trust on its own without, you know, look beyond what's being delegated to the community. Thanks.
Thank you. George, go ahead.
Well, I don't think we're far apart on this question, but there are two things I just add. So first, in the 3.2F of the community agreement, yes, it's fine to give an affirmative obligation to the OC to do monitoring. But I don't necessarily think that the trust should give up all responsibility to the OC. I mean, I don't think this takes away at all from the OC's job, but certainly, you know, as the owner, it shouldn't abdicate all responsibility, and it, you know, this can be mutual, right? Why can't there be multiple parties observing the quality, you know, of the services that are associated with the mark? I don't think that takes away anything. In fact, I think it just makes the process stronger because you have, you know, you've got multiple eyes watching something. The point about adding stuff to the license agreement for context, I think that's fine. I think we can and we should do that and you know, give a better picture of how quality control is occurring under the license agreement. You know, at the end of the day, it's the trust's duty, as Greg points out, to police and monitor quality control or monitor quality of the services. And those, by the way, the quality of the services and the quality of the uses of the trademarks and connections with the services here, I think they really do converge. I mean, there's I think probably 100% overlap. So, you know, there's really one thing that's being monitored. The fear that I have in the license agreement and the thing that I want to avoid is just adding extraneous obligations to the license agreement, adding extra ways that the service provider can say that the trust is breaching. And this is one of the reasons that I would like to leave out all of the obligations as between the trust and the OCs, you know, in the license agreement, right? I don't want the licensee to be able to say, oh, well, you know, the trust didn't, you know, get this approval or that approval or this, you know, meeting or whatever didn't happen, and so you breached, right? That the interaction between the trust and the OCs is not the the service provider's business. And we can put in, you know, more clauses for transparency to say what's going to happen, but to make those affirmative obligations in the license agreement just seems to be opening it up, you know, to claims that really don't have any place there, right? So I think we can find good language to reassure everybody to how the quality control is being done without giving the licensee, you know, new ways to claim that the license agreement, you know, isn't being complied with.
Thank you, George. Go ahead, Athena.
I'm a little bit confused, and I would like your help a little bit to clarify this. To me, there are two things, right? It's the use of the intellectual property and the quality of the service. With regards to the quality of the service, we have the right to monitor this. And this right we have in our agreement, in our SLA with ICANN. It is a right. I wonder, does this now have to become an obligation in our agreement with the trust? Or is this an obligation that deals with the quality of service? It's about the quality of service, or is it about just the use of the intellectual property? Can you still hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. So in our SLA, this is a right. And I wonder if now this has to become an obligation to the trust, and to what extent, to the quality of the service or to the use of intellectual property alone.
Thanks, Athena. Sam, go ahead.
Hi, thanks. This is Sam Eisner from ICANN, and some of you may have had the opportunity, and I know we'll get to this in the next part of the agenda on the edits that ICANN provided to the license agreement. But I know from our standpoint, we'd be really concerned not having the controls that are included throughout the community and the different community, the different operating communities and how they are each responsible for monitoring the service that they're getting from PTI and delivering those IANA services. And Alyssa, a lot like what you said earlier, that it's not actually part of the proposal to have the IATF trust in a role of overseeing or reviewing the services that the IANA functions provider will be doing. We'd similarly, from ICANN, we'd have a really big concern entering into a license agreement that even though there might be a community agreement underneath it where all the controls could be specified, that if the license agreement with ICANN authorized the IATF trust to have the ability to oversee and take action against ICANN as a, or PTI or ICANN as a licensee because of service-related issues without any tethering to requirements from each of the operating communities, we'd have a lot of problems entering into that because on its face, that license agreement would be inconsistent with the proposals and also inconsistent with what we understood the object of this to be, which was to move the IPR over, but not in any other way affect the proposals or the rights of the operating communities.
Thanks, Sam. I sort of got in the queue to reiterate some of the same points, which is that I think that this notion of sort of adding another set of eyes is actually quite controversial, because the whole sort of the whole project of the transition was to determine whose eyes are going to be on the services, and you know, hopefully over the course of 2 years we hammered out some agreements about how that's going to be done. So I don't think this should really be any sort of vehicle for adding another set of eyes. But I'm also, I am just really having trouble understanding the linkage between the quality of the services and the sort of public understanding of the quality of the brand or the mark, because to me the two really have basically no connection. So I'm a little unclear on what the path forward is here, based on the things that various people have said. I definitely agree that with this notion of this separation in terms of what the license agreement specifies and what the community agreement specifies, and that really this process should not require specifying much at all about the communities in the license agreement, because that's the channel for their interaction really is with the trust and not with ICANN with respect to the IPR. But it's not totally obvious to me how that's going to be achieved yet. So if somebody else thinks that we have some sort of consensus here and that they can summarize, that would be useful, but I'm not quite grasping it at the moment. George, go ahead.
Yeah, I think we can do this. Maybe I'm overly optimistic, but you know, this is, right, first of all, to answer, Alyssa, your question, that the quality of the SIS and the quality of the use of the mark, again, I believe they are one and the same, right? You know, when a subcontractor manufactures Nike shoes and Nike, you know, authorizes putting a trademark on the shoes, you know, if they're poor quality shoes, that damages Nike's trademark. I mean, the analogy is simplistic, but it's exactly the same thing. The mark, the IANA mark, would be damaged, diminished in value if the services are of a lower quality than you would expect them to be for IANA services. We've got the benchmark, you know, from the existing ICANN services, and we'll have the SLAs to tell us what they should be in the future. As far as policing and monitoring the quality, I think it's fine to say that the trust will turn to the experts, right? Turn to the OC who's, you know, responsible for those services in making any kind of quality assessment. Again, I think it's really just a question of semantics, and I'm sorry to have introduced the multiple sets of eyes analogy. Let's just drop that. We'll just disregard that. I retract it. You know, on the point about what should go in the license agreement, I think we can put a lot of context in here. I think that's appropriate, and I think that's fine. I'm not, it's going to take another round or two, I think, with Sam and you know, the communities looking at it to see if it's as far as they want and is, you know, but not farther than the trust really can go. I thought that the initial CWG insertion of community-related obligations into the license agreement might have been too much. It might have given too many avenues to the licensee. Again, keeping in mind that the licensee might not always be ICANN. However, you know, taking all of that out and leaving it, you know, kind of a generic license agreement just between the trusts and the licensee, That also rubs the wrong way given the history of this transaction. So I think there's a middle ground there, and you know, I think we'll try very hard to make the next draft accommodate, you know, all of these concerns.
Okay, good. Well, since I have a feeling you're going to be on the hook for the next draft, and the fact that you think you can produce something here that satisfies everyone is cause for optimism. So thank you. So I know we want to talk about how the next drafts are going to come about, but maybe it makes sense to do item number 3 first, since clearly there is, although the ICANN comments didn't actually touch on the community agreement, there is some interplay between the license agreement and the community agreement. So unless people object, I think let's move to item number three, and then after that we can come back and talk about the drafting process for all of the agreements. I see no objections. So these are red lines that we got from ICANN, and at least from what I was thinking was maybe, Sam, if you want to sort of give us the highlights or talk through the highlights of the edits here. I don't think we necessarily want to go through paragraph by paragraph, but maybe you can give a summary, and then if there's specific items that people saw in reading them and they have reactions to, then we can take it from there.
Thanks, Alyssa. That sounds good. I think we should go to the license agreement first, and then those on the call, like George, I don't know what your thoughts are on the assignment agreement. Is that something you'd want to talk about in this avenue, or would you like to handle that directly with ICANN? I think that, you know, we should consider that. So let's start with the license agreement here. Natalie, if you can put up the red line that was sent yesterday on that.
I think most of the people here haven't read Diamond Agreement, and we've never actually talked about it, so I'd probably hold off on that.
Yeah, great. And Natalie, you're getting the red line up? Upload in progress. So just as an overview, and to take Alyssa's point that we don't really want to walk line by line through this, so you'll see that there are in some places line edits to this document, so clarification of effective date, clarification of some of the definitions that align with the the edits that we've made. And so with that, unless people have questions about it, I think that we can turn to the bottom of page three. And so on quality requirements, and I think this also goes to enforcement. And if you can scroll up a little bit, so if we can see the rest of the document. Over the bridge of the page, to page four. So I think that some of these quality requirements have to do with the conversation we were just having. So we'll just flag here that we had some changes in here. On the usage requirements on 2.3, we made some changes to it, and we also made some edits to the appendix that was offered on the usage requirements. Understanding that the IPR will be held by the IETF Trust, there still is a need for ICANN and PTI to have some assurance that they won't have to start doing a bunch of operational changes like changing logos and changing business cards and those sorts of things that might use the license terms because there was a decision to change how they're used. And so I think it's something that just from an operational standpoint, that understanding that we might want to change some of these things over time, that the provision that was drafted seemed a little bit onerous to ICANN as the entity at this point or through PTI that's responsible for delivering all three of the services, that there was an opportunity for that to change a little bit under ICANN's feet. So that was the basis for that change when you review it. I'm going to move to Article 3. We're flipping back and forth here between controls. We do have we added some language at 3.2 regarding situations where ICANN holds some of the licenses, even not all three of the licenses, and the need for there to still be consistency in the registration in that event. So if you can take a look at that language. Can you go to the next page, Natalie?
Sam, can I just ask you a question about that one? Because it's kind of a technical question. So, you know, the way the conversation has gone here is that there will be three license agreements, right? One each of the services. So does that that's what your 3.2 is responding to. If we terminate one out of three, I guess I'm just not sure I understand the 3.2, how 3.2 works with the three agreements.
Yeah, so 3.2, I think has to go, there still has to be a singular point of contact, right, for reference within the registration. And so there has to be a decision, and maybe this is just a starting point for some other conversation among the communities themselves about what the intention is if there is a termination of one of the three licenses or even two of the three licenses, and yet ICANN is still delivering IANA services to one or two of the operational communities. Who would be expected to be in that registration? How will we expect to see the technical contacts listed? Under the ICANN proposal that you see in here, it's that would remain unchanged until a point where ICANN was not a licensee for any of the operating communities, but that might be something that this group wants to discuss further.
Yeah, it's actually a very good point, and one that is not a point for me at all. It's really a technical question that I hadn't thought about before, which is what happens to IANA.org when we have three different service providers, for example.
Right.
For the group, I see Ted's hand is up, and maybe he's going to answer it.
That'd be great. Ted?
Well, I also see Andrew saying that he has an answer to this, and that was why his hand is up. So I will defer to Andrew and then return to the queue, if that's okay.
Okay. When we discussed this before, and when we were talking about the terms and when we discussed this on various occasions, I think everybody has recognized that IANA.org is a problem because you can't basically divide IANA.org 3, and there basically isn't a good way to do this. The straightforward way, as Russ suggests in the chat and Paul, is to put three subdomains underneath IANA.org, and nobody will control IANA.org. That is, there won't be a license to it. There will be a license instead to, you know, protocols.iana.org and numbers.iana.org and names.iana.org, and those would be the things that would be given out. IANA.org would be effectively in DNS we call it an empty non-terminal. Although, as a practical matter, we probably put like a redirector website there so that you could find the thing that you wanted to. But it would be, you know, sort of empty. There would be no content at that name. And that way, we could solve this. The reason we did not suggest actually to do that, you know, before the transition and get that all in place and so on was, quite frankly, that there were political concerns. We talked about it and people said, no, that's political concerns. It suggests that, you know, these things are going to split up in the future, and then everybody panicked. And so we just didn't do it. What I would like to suggest is that for the practical purposes of this, we've got to figure out a way that we can be creatively ambiguous in this part of the agreement, and then we can sort out the individual subdomains after the transition. just in order to get past that political argument, which I didn't believe, but it didn't seem like there was going to be a way to resolve anyway. I don't know if people are comfortable with that sort of creative ambiguity. I get it that the idea of putting creative ambiguity in a contract is not maybe the kind of thing that people want to do, but there really actually is not a technical way to solve this problem otherwise, and the natural way to do it actually would be for the trust to run this, and the trust does not want to.
Ted, I don't know if you wanted to come in behind that.
Yes, because I think my answer is slightly different to Andrew's, but along many of the same lines. I think at the moment what we need to say is that as part of this agreement, the trust will license to the operator, in effect, to ICANN, and will make ICANN the technical point of contact, but it will retain itself as the administrative point of contact. And this, I think, agreement should be silent on what should happen in the future should ICANN cease to be the operator of the domain name, because it's always up, as I understand this, to the administrative contact to declare a new technical point of contact. And so it might be in the future, for example, that ICANN itself wanted to designate a different technical point of contact because it was picking an external party to run the domain name on its behalf. And it would then work with the administrative contact to make that change. So I think I wouldn't actually say that this is creative ambiguity. It's deciding that we don't need to go this far into the future in this particular agreement, and we simply say that for the purposes of instantiating this, ICANN will continue to be the technical contact, but that the trust will become the administrative contact and may redesignate should circumstances require.
Thanks. Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that ICANN was trying to do in this situation and with inserting it into this technical contact section was to get rid of some of the ambiguity around around when the IETF trust would have the freedom to decide that circumstances required. So I think, you know, it sounds like there's a little bit more conversation to happen within the community, and clearly there can be a certain level of ambiguity, but I think that this is one of those areas where, because this is in some ways a very unique license and how, you know, this domain name registration is being handled, et cetera, we do need to be a bit careful on it. But, you know, we look forward to see what the community's come up with in response to this. So I'll move on. Again, a lot of these are small line edits for you to take a look at. We did put in at 4.2 a specific reservation that other trademarks owned by ICANN, such as ICANN and the accredited registrar logo, et cetera, are not impacted by this and are not confusingly similar to the trademarks that are being or the license marks that will be transferred over. The biggest area of change that you'll see is in the policing and enforcement, or one of the biggest areas. So that's at 4.3. And I think from the conversation that was happening earlier on the areas of agreement, it sounds like the communities have already started thinking about some ways to modify this. So I think that this is one of those areas that's in play, so we'd encourage you to look at the language that ICANN has incorporated in here as part of how you're moving forward with proposing new language on this section, because I think it's a bit closer to where it sounds like the group is ending up than where it was from the IETF draft from the 30th. on Article 5, indemnification, we've inserted in here a mutual indemnification, so there would be indemnification from the licensee, but also from the licensor. And to the extent that ICANN was subject to a claim or liability arising from acts of the licensor.
Can I jump in on that?
Sure.
And explain, right? So, I mean, it obviously, you know, wasn't just an oversight that we didn't include indemnification from the licensor in this section. And the reason is the following, right? This is not a typical trademark license, in which, you know, we have an existing, set of IP or an existing set of marks that we license to somebody to go off and exploit in different places. The marks that are being licensed are from, ICANN, right? I mean, you've developed them, and have been using them through the transition date. And, you know, to say that if the name IANA, infringes, you know, a trademark in some other country, and that happens, the claim is brought after the transition, and it doesn't seem like it's the trust's responsibility, or it shouldn't be the trust's responsibility to indemnify ICANN for, you know, that claim. Because really the claim arises from the development and use of a mark, you know, before the transition, right? We didn't create the mark. And since the services are basically the same and the marks are basically the same, you know, it just didn't seem, I mean, we gave this quite a bit of thought, but it didn't seem that indemnification to ICANN for use of these marks was right.
I understand that where that would have come from. We also understand that, you know, when there are certain obligations that come to those who hold marks. And so, you know, I think it's something that maybe you want to discuss further. But, you know, so this is where ICANN is at the moment. You know, we did try to limit it to things that happened after the effective date. Of course, the IANA mark has been in existence for quite a while, and we've never had any sort of claim of this type, so it hasn't really been an issue. But to the extent that that we would be asked to indemnify the licensor, we would also like to request that mutual indemnification. So I see that as an area where we'll have some further conversation. So moving down, the next place where you'll see some substantial change is within Article 6, and this is on the termination rights. And this really directly implicates the conversation we had just prior to this about that quality control issue. ICANN has a very big concern that the language that's currently within the IETF version of this document from July 30th gives a lot of right to the IETF trust to terminate the license based on quality control factors. And we had a really big concern over that. I think that some of the lines of discussion that we had about the use of the mark versus the quality control of services and the changes that might come out of that might be instructive and might have some of this, you might want to propose that some of this language comes in. But that really is the genesis of ICANN's concerns with that section, that it was really tied too closely to the IETF trust being able to use the license agreement as a measure of its assessment of the quality of services being delivered. Alyssa?
Yeah, so I was just wondering, sort of in light of that whole previous conversation, and now that we have at least the sort of in principle agreement about the quality and the termination provisions, if those essentially get hammered out properly in the community agreement as it sounds like people are on board with, then if you think just sort of just referencing that here would be sufficient. I guess my concern in reviewing this briefly before the call is that we have basically the same set of what should be the same set of provisions replicated in two different agreements, and really there should just be one authoritative source for the termination and the quality things. Because it's all up to the communities and the trusts, it seemed to me that, you know, those go in the community agreement and then we could just cross-reference. Is that, based on the conversation that we had in the last hour and a half, do you see that as a workable approach?
Yeah, I think that that's something we'd definitely be willing to consider. Our concern would be entering into an agreement that there was no sort of cross-reference or no reference to the community role at all, and having that be kind of a black box to the license agreement, because I think, you know, we see that we have an obligation to make sure that the license agreement we enter into is consistent with the proposals without some sort of cross-reference out, if not the replication of the language. You know, however that winds up happening, I don't think we'd have that comfort within the four corners of the document. So we're not wedded to how we did it here. This was just a way of demonstrating how we thought it might be appropriate to be done. And if there can be cross-reference to particular sections of the community agreement or anything, you know, we'd certainly be willing to consider that.
Okay, thanks.
So I think this next section on 6.4 is right in line with what we were just talking about. So I think we can defer the rest of the conversation on this section to once we see the outputs that'll come after our conversation today. We did want to put in at 6.5 a clarification that if there is a termination of all three licenses, that this agreement would terminate. And then the effective termination, you'll see just some line edits there. We did add in a section on remedies for breach, including notice and cure periods, mediation, so that we did have an opportunity to have a breach escalation path as it relates to the use of the marks. And so please read this section as well in relation to the termination section above that we had deleted and in light of our conversations. And we did think it was important to make sure that it was phrased in the possibility for either party to breach and not just the licensor or the licensee. And then we added in, moving down Article 8, we added in some additional language under the warranty section. We do have a concern that there could be we're wondering about the what if, and it sounds like this might be a bit of the what if that the community's discussed as well in terms of the assignment question that we heard earlier and the agreement to go back and see if there's any ability to modify the trust documents. But we did have a concern of, you know, what if something happens to the trust? We don't want to be in a position, we don't think the community would be well served to be in a position to have the IPR that's been deemed as essential for the performance of the IANA functions to be in play. And so we've put in some provisions here about how, you know, we've put in here that it would go back to ICANN. We'd clearly be interested to hear if there are other proposals from the community on that. But also, you know, if there really is a failure on a part of the IETF trust to enforce or to take on any sort of maintenance or enforcement activities, so that would be a situation that would cause ICANN concern that the marks were not being properly monitored and might trigger a need to have those returned back to ICANN. Now, that could also be part of the breach and the specific performance of a breach situation, too, but take a look at that. Ted?
I think I actually wanted to go back to the mediation section since we talked a bit on this. This seems to require that the mediation go through a very specific set of mediators and is a bit more formal than I think we were talking about in the discussions when an operating community might have a need to discuss something with a trust. And in particular, because this requires us to be, I guess we're entitled to be represented by counsel, but if you turn up without one and the other side does, you're your own client, and we all know how that goes. I'm a bit concerned about including this. I mean, I think we need to include a consultation, as you heard us suggest in a previous part of the call, but I'm a bit concerned with us going to this level of discussion here, because I really want us to be curing this without going into 60 and 90 day periods and all of this. But in essence, what I'd like to see us do here, if we can, is to have a common method of mediation or consultation among all the parties that might need a consultation period. I'm not completely opposed to this, but I would like it to be a little bit freer, if we can make it a little bit freer, but I would really like it to be common so that the way the consultation works with the operating communities or the way it works with the licensor is the same. I also wanted to go back to your point about what happens if the trust essentially disappeared off the face of the earth, right? Theory states that because the trustees get together, you know, an earthquake or some lottery award could cause them to disappear off the face of the planet, but there are actually mechanisms in the trust itself for recreating the trustees should the trustees themselves disappear. So I think what you're looking at here at this point is a mechanism that would get invoked only after the trustees, any individual set of trustees, were subject to recall by the community. And so I don't believe that this is really something that we should be spending a lot of effort to argue about, but I don't think that this is really where we want to be right now.
George?
I'll actually just add a couple of things to what Ted said on both of these points. Right on the mediation point, lighter touch, I agree, sounds like the way to go. Also, I don't know, Sam, if you were part of the discussion when we talked about governing law and so forth under the community agreement, but the compromise that we've reached with the communities is to agree to have California law govern the agreements, but not agree to go to California to resolve all disputes. So all of this stuff that you've got in here about you must go to the Central District of California, this is all going to happen in ICANN's backyard, you know, that's obviously a little bit overreaching, and I think that the compromise we reached with the communities is probably a fair one, which is, you know, wherever jurisdiction lies, the parties can go, because, you know, there are obviously cost, convenience, and bias implications to going to one of the parties' backyards. The other thing on the transfer, you know, again, as we've been discussing with the communities and worked out in that 7 points document that we discussed at the beginning of the call, you know, the trust is willing to float the idea of a transfer of the intellectual property if there's some egregious breach of the agreements. I mean, the way this is written is a little bit aggressive. If there's an immediate transfer, if a trust fails to cooperate, you know, an enforcement decision, I think, you know, obviously suggestive stuff like that we would need to deal with. But that aside, I think the point that I got from the communities, and I could be very wrong, is that there could be some alternate recipient of the IP other than the trust, but not necessarily that it would be ICANN. And so, you know, if we sort of march down the path that I think we've started down with the communities toward amending the trust agreement to allow a transfer, you know, I think that we would at least, in all of these agreements, just need to remain open-ended as to who the recipient was, whether it's a new trust that's formed, whether it's some new entity that the CCG forms, or whatnot. It could be any of those possibilities. I think hardwiring a transfer back to ICANN here to some degree, you know, makes all of the work that's gone into the transfer from ICANN, less durable, and wouldn't want to see it all go to waste.
Yeah, so we, you know, ICANN hasn't necessarily been part of all the community conversations to date on this, and so, you know, we think it would be, it sounds like we're all on that point, we're thinking about the same issue and trying to think about it in ways that could lead to a productive solution. You know, I think that to the extent that the community would come up with some other, if it would go to a different entity, you know, I think we would want to make sure that there were considerations of neutrality and making sure that it wasn't going to be used for commercial benefit and, you know, not against the interests of either the operator or the operating communities, and that the license would be available on the same terms, et cetera. You're right. So the same kind of protections would have to be thought about, and it's not I think that it sounds like we're focusing on the same potential problem, though. And so it sounds like there are some other paths to get to that solution. We'd be surely open to looking at it. and, you know, on the venue and jurisdiction, we'll surely take a look at the language that came through. Again, we weren't part of that community solution on it. We were responding to the jurisdiction statement that was in there, in the document itself. So we'll take a look and see what comes out of that. You know, we can move forward and see what we get on that. Andrew?
So I'm a little concerned about the drift of this conversation, because the ICG report on this was crystal clear that this stuff can't go back to ICANN. That's the whole point of this transfer. And to get these comments as late as we did, given how long ago we shipped this to you, and to be negotiating over this kind of thing is really very frustrating. I really think that we need to find out precisely which things you absolutely cannot live with. We've got like a week to do this, and we have to ship this thing out. And this sounds to me like what you're trying to do is relitigate the discussion that we had almost a year ago with the RIRs. So I really want to push back on this thing. I mean, I get it that you're worried about a potential problem here, but this is a risk that is so small that you're either going to have to say, well, what is the risk to the transition if this thing doesn't get done, or what is the risk that the trust is going to disappear? And I think that if we actually have to evaluate the respective risks of those things, one of them is considerably worse for ICANN than the other. So it would be helpful if we could focus on the things that actually got us to the end of the thing and not talk about opening terms that have been in the ICG proposal for a long time. Thanks.
Thanks, Andrew. So as I indicated earlier, you know, I also acknowledge that sounds like there's been a lot of community conversation going on about this, and, you know, that there could be some other solutions. I think I already spoke to that. I think it is important to address the what if, but I don't necessarily know, or I'm not going to tell you that the what if has to be resolved with a return back to ICANN. I understand the concerns that you've raised, but I think the what if is an important item, and it sounds like there's actually been a lot of positive movement on that within the community, and so maybe there's language that can be brought into this from there. So I'll continue.
Sam, just a time check because we have 10 minutes left in this call, and it's really late for the folks in Europe and elsewhere. So maybe if we can just hit the sort of remaining highlights of this agreement, and I think just very briefly, if we can look at the assignment agreement as well, and then reserve 3 minutes at the end to figure out next steps, that would be good.
Sure, Alyssa. You know, we're basically there. I think we've hit on all the big points. There's some legal language that was added towards the end, but also the one big thing that we've added is that 9.15, no third-party beneficiary status. We think that's important for both the trust and for ICANN to have in there. And then you'll see we had some slight modifications to the appendices, but again, those are just added to take a look at. So with that, if you want to flash up the assignment agreement, I can just talk at a very high level on that. So here's the assignment agreement that was proposed by the IETF Trust to ICANN. A lot of what you'll see in here, again, are high-level edits and places where we thought the language could be simplified. We have asked for a little bit more time, given that this will all happen right around the time of the transition. There's a 3-day proposed time frame, and we asked for a 30-day time frame, and we'd, of course, try to work a little bit more quickly within that, but we didn't want to set up time frames in here that we couldn't meet. One of the most important things I think you'll see in here is that at Article 3, we've now incorporated two new clauses. One would be the requirement that contemporaneously with the signing of the assignment agreement that there would be a license back to ICANN, and that at the community agreement as well, that contemporaneously with the signing of the assignment agreement, there would be a community agreement as the community is developing. We think that those are really important things to have noted in the assignment agreement because it really is part of a package and not the black box, and making sure the proper terms there are in place are really important for ICANN in entering into the assignment agreement. And then moving through, there again, it's mostly just line edits at this point. It changes to some of the legal language and how, small details. But the big picture in this one would be the incorporation of the license and the community agreement in here.
Ted, if you're speaking, you're muted.
Howdy. So I'm looking at 7.7, and again, I'm not a lawyer, so I may be misreading this completely, but it looks like it says that the IETF Trust cannot assign this intellectual property without prior written consent of ICANN. And I don't think that actually matches our understanding of the fiduciary duty of the trust and how it can or cannot seek approvals. And there was actually a long discussion of that that came up in the last call, which I'm sorry, may have not included you and the ICANN folks. But I'm quite concerned about this being present in it, and I don't think we can do it.
Thanks, Ted. We'd be interested to see what the trust believes is important or appropriate here. And this is particularly important in the event, and maybe this is something that should be reflected in the license agreement as opposed to in this agreement, that to the extent the IETF trust is considering assigning the IPR that ICANN is a party to the license of, that it really would be important to give some notice and opportunity to ICANN to evaluate who that's going to make sure that it remains consistent with the proposals and the neutral entity. Andrew?
So I actually completely do not understand why that is any of ICANN's business. The communities are the ones who are in charge of this. ICANN is the operator in that case, and ICANN will have transferred this stuff away and gotten out of the way. So this actually seems to me to be like, you know, a dead hand clause that is there actually to extend ICANN's control over these marks well past the intention of the communities, which told you that you can't control these things after the transition. That's what the whole ICG proposal says, and 7.7 flies in the face of it. So I cannot see how this can be acceptable, because I can't see how it's consistent with the ICG proposal, which, again, has been out for a long time.
So I think that we all need to, all parts of the community need to be clear that some of the proposals and some of the principles that were laid out from a year ago in the transfer of the intellectual property, are those important to be maintained? And is it going to an entity that ICANN will be able to maintain a relationship with? What are the terms that it's going to be at? Is ICANN going to expect to have different terms of that license agreement? There has to be some business consistency for ICANN that has to be maintained. It's not a level of control over the marks, but there has to be some level of business continuity that can be assured to ICANN in the use of these marks. And that's really the objective that we're getting to. It's not about control. It's about making sure that ICANN has the opportunity to have consistency in its business operations and isn't subject to the whim of a different licensor coming in deciding to terminate a license or whatever. So that's the type of concern that we have in here. That's what this is generated to address. And so if there are other ways that the community or the ITIP Trust wants to propose to handle that, again, this might be more appropriate for the license agreement, we'd be happy to consider that.
So I put my hand back in, so I'll just respond to that. This is completely inappropriate for this agreement. Maybe it goes to the license agreements. I'm not actually convinced that the community has told you that you were going to get the business continuity that you want. It seems to me that the ICG proposal actually tells you what business continuity you're allowed to expect, and I'm not sure that it's consistent with what you're expecting here. But in any case, it doesn't belong in this assignment agreement, because what you're doing here is attempting to import into the assignment agreement considerations about your role post-transition as the IANA functions operator. And the whole point of this transfer was, in fact, to prevent you from being able to do that. So this term has just got to be removed.
So jumping in here. So we are almost at the hour. We have two more people who have just joined the queue, and then it will take us a little bit of time to talk about the next steps here. So are we going to lose anybody at the hour? Speak now if you can't stay 5-10 minutes over. Okay, so we will have Athena and then Ted and back to Sam for the conclusion, and then we will talk about next steps.
Yes, thank you. I have to agree with Andrew totally. The proposal was very clear on that. ICANN was supposed to transfer these rights to the IANA Trust, and after that, it won't have any control over them. And the only relationship ICANN can control with the trust is that is regulated by the license agreement. And that's all. And in the license agreement, ICANN will be just the licensee. And no more control will be given to ICANN than the pure rights of a licensee. Nothing more. It's very clear. Thank you.
Go ahead, Ted.
So I wanted to get back to the point that Sam raised about business continuity, because it's obvious that that's a great concern of theirs, and obvious that you want to provide a good service to the operating communities who will be using ICANN services for IANA in the post-transition world. And I want to say that I think the right way to do this is with consultation with the operational communities themselves, that if the operational communities feel that there's a problem here, we all have to work together in consultation between the ITF Trust and the operational communities about any failure of business continuity would be important and would be taken seriously, but that it is their operation at this point, and that as a matter of the new organization that I believe people have put even more strongly, ICANN has to see themselves in that role in order for this to work. And I sincerely hope that, you know, at the 11th hour and 35th or maybe even 55th minute, we're not going to fall down on this particular point, because I believe to serve the internet community correctly, we should just accept that the new set of organizational paradigms has come into force and make this agreement consonant with them. Thank you.
Thanks, Ted. Sam, did you have any concluding remarks or responses there?
Sure. On that, you know, I think I hope this conversation and this end part has been helpful in us trying to clarify why it is that we put this in here, right? This isn't, it really isn't about control. It's about, as I believe it was Ted just said, it's about making sure that excellence in service continues to be delivered. And we, you know, whether it's something that's more explicit within the community agreement or how that can be done, there has to be some sort of mechanism for the community to continue to work together, even in the face of choosing to a different place to assign the IPR, et cetera, keeping in mind the goal of, you know, why are we going through this exercise of trying to negotiate a license with ICANN if the intent would be assign it out and let someone else just, you know, change it. And so, you know, I think that we really are all aligned in the fact that, you know, we're having PTI as a service delivery mechanism. We'll have a license to perform, license to use the marks that we'll use in the performance of the service, subject to the termination provisions from each of the three operating communities. Those are things that we've taken on board. We're there. We're working with you on it. And so we just want to make sure that there aren't weird changes in the rules of the game that come just because there are items that weren't flagged in the part of the discussion of this agreement. And again, this does not have to be in the assignment agreement. Maybe it's in the community agreement. Maybe it's in the license agreement. But I think this conversation has brought to light an important aspect that, again, is already a bit under consideration with the group. So thanks.
Thanks, Sam. Okay, I'm glad that we managed to at least start the discussion there. So we have to figure out a game plan here as a group because we have not a lot of time left, and clearly we're not all quite agreed on text just yet. So I think in terms of action plan, in the chat we had sounds like agreement that the 6 points are going to be shared with the CWG before the CWG's call tomorrow, and that's that will be the basis of CWG discussion, which I think is a good idea. Then what I was going to propose regarding the community agreement is that I think the sort of paradigm that we used in the early part of this week, where George and Josh kind of worked together on hashing something out and then shared it back individually with the trust and with the CWG respectively, and then after that with the full group based on the two parties' happiness with what they came up with. I think that seemed to work quite well. So I was wondering if George and Josh, if you would be willing to do that again, except in the context of the actual text of the agreement, and to maybe tackle the community agreement first and try to get that, you know, circulated out to folks as soon as you possibly can. And then perhaps try to do the same thing with the license agreement and the assignment agreement vis-a-vis ICANN's comments. I don't know, George, if you would be willing to do that kind of bilateral back and forth a little bit with Sam and the ICANN folks as well, see what progress can be made, and then bring those things back to the communities afterward. So I guess what I'm looking for here is from George and Josh and Sam, if you're willing to do the lawyer-to-lawyer thing on short order, and if the community folks are okay with that kind of model.
That certainly works for me. This is George.
And Sam from ICANN as well.
Okay, great. And I see Josh is typing. So then the next question is in terms of timing and when we all get back together as a group to hopefully start to finalize at least some of these things. We don't have a lot of time, especially if we're going to get these out to public comment before ICANN's report to NTIA goes in. So my proposal would be that we schedule a call for this Friday and see what progress has been made, and schedule one potentially for early next week as well, knowing that we can always cancel if we're done or what have you, and we can doodle immediately for times. But the proposal would be, I guess, Friday and Monday, potentially, with the notion that we're trying to get these to public comment next Thursday. Josh, go ahead.
Sorry, trying to unmute. I think that that sounds like a pretty sensible plan. Alyssa, my only concern would be whether we'd, you know, really be in a position to share something with the sort of broad group by Friday. I think if George and I are trying to do some exchanges and you know, sort of inevitably we'll probably want to consult at least informally with, you know, members of with some of our respective clients just to get informal feedback to help make as polished a draft for sharing as possible. It might be something that, and partly because I've got time zone challenges on my end, it might be something that we'd be in a position to circulate hopefully a better draft and have a more polished conversation or more polished draft by Monday, but I'm not sure that Friday is feasible.
Okay.
And I fully appreciate our timeline.
And I know that the time zones don't work out well for people when we schedule calls on Fridays. My only concern with Monday is that it doesn't. If everything isn't resolved Monday, then it doesn't leave us a whole lot of time to try and resolve. I mean, we could certainly schedule Monday and Wednesday as well.
No, I agree, and also I actually think that there may be the assignment agreement itself may be something. I mean, if you're trying to run things in parallel tracks, George and Sam may be able to get something that would be ready for another review on Friday, or at least have, you know, sort of narrowed the issues to something by Friday, because admittedly, I don't think that has as much, there's as much sensitivity to issues in the actual assignment agreement from at least not as much sensitivity from the names community, and probably not as much sensitivity from the other communities. So long as, you know, core principles are being adhered to. So that might be something that could be pegged for a Friday call, and a Monday call to review the license and community agreement. I don't know what, I don't want to speak for George because I think you've been tasked with doing the next turn. And I don't know what your schedule is like, but I think I could try to make that work, at least on our end.
Yes, George, I think that, I mean, I never would have thought that there would be a draft for people to review on Friday. And I thought Friday was a short check-in call, but no, there's just producing these drafts takes days. So this is not, you know, a quick job. Monday, I think, is ambitious in itself, but I think we can do it.
Okay, let's do this. Let us doodle for times for Friday, Monday, and Wednesday. We'll put things on the calendar. If Friday it turns out we don't have much to look at, then it'll be short. And if we do have more to look at, then we'll take the whole time. And if people can't make it and it's the weekend in your part of the world, that's understood, obviously. Athena?
Yes, sorry, just a technicality. I understand that the dial-in information is only shared with those that that appear to be available based on the doodle. I would ask there with a whole list. Please. Would that be possible?
Yes. Sorry. I was just going to say, with Natalie and Brenda, and make sure that you get onto the distribution for the scheduling emails.
Thank you.
Okay, Josh, are you back in the queue? I don't think so. I think that's from before. Okay, great. So I think we have a plan, and the notes from this meeting will be circulated, and doodles will be sent out. Please fill out the doodles as soon as you can so we can get the future call schedules. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you all.